Early in the morning parted, as one of the blonde men saw me to the door and jokingly dismissed me with, "Farewell, maestro." It was still dark, but I started up the car knowing I would be shown the direction back to the main roads. So I just drove wherever my subconscious indicated, and in a very little while recognized a familiar highway. Once or twice I have tried to find the wooded area again when I have been in that section, but without success. I couldn't wait until I could find a friend's house where there was a piano, where I suddenly walked to the instrument, sat down and played a popular song. As all my friends would exclaim later, this particular one remarked, "But, Howard, you didn't tell us you could play." I had been told that anyone hearing the music the space friend and my soul had taught me would get a feeling, or reach an awareness, which would act as a mental assist to release something from the subconscious. People hearing the theme would react in their conscious state with increased understanding and brotherly love toward one another. Every musical note, they had explained, has its specific density and frequency which causes a sympathetic vibration. When created at the correct frequency and in certain combinations, witness a glass breaking in the presence of a high-pitched musical note. This, of course, is an oversimplified example of what happens to the subconscious when certain music is heard, but its principle is similar. In short, sound causes a corresponding effect in one's innermost mind. For many months I played the music all over the country, as I noted it did have a noticeable effect upon those who heard it. I taped the music and sent it around to various study groups, but knowing that few people have access to tape recorders, I finally was able to have a long playing record of the music issued for the public. The congenial president of Slate Enterprises, Newark, NJ, was so impressed by the music he suggested we produce the record, which we titled, very appropriately I thought, Music from Another Planet, now available on Slate record number 211. In time I realized that whenever I sat down at the piano and allowed my fingers to stray, other music came through. This became as much a surprise to me as to my friends and relatives who had never heard me play before. For years I had tried to pick out melodies on the piano with little success. This was but one of the gifts awakened in me by my brothers from outer space, to whom I am eternally grateful. 21, Marla. In the excitement and confusion I had almost forgotten what my friends had told me of a certain man from Yucca Valley, California, whom they promised I would meet. In October of 1956, however, I must have been led to go through a certain batch of my now huge collection of notes and data, for there on a scrap of paper, underlined heavily, was the name of a hotel and room number. Above the information I had penciled, men from Yucca Valley conducting experiments. This was one of the men they said were conducting work far ahead of conventional scientists. I smiled knowingly to myself as I saw the predicted date for our meeting and noted it was near. I wondered if he had any pre-knowledge of our proposed meeting. Later he confirmed that he knew he was to meet someone in the East but hadn't been told the name. I also wondered what the fellow's name was, but soon learned. The next day after I found the note, a friend telephoned excitedly. "Howard, a man is coming to New York whom you'll want to meet. I can't wait to go to his lecture." I asked who the man was. "George Van Somebody." Then he got out a letter from a friend. "George Van Tassel." Note, the claim of Van Tassel about his contact with the Confederation agent in the desert was real. The Alliance also see him as a real contact as well as stated on their website. However, Van Tassel's belief the channelings of etheric beings was imprinting from opposing groups to discredit him. Louise, he's had contacts with the space people, and is head of the College of Universal Wisdom. Does he make experiments of some kind? I asked. "That I don't know. She, evidently the person writing my friend, doesn't say. I figured this must be my man, and when the date of his arrival came I couldn't wait to get into New York and meet him. Bill Thompson drove me into the city, and we went to his hotel. I called his room and checked my notes against the name. In a few minutes George Van Tassel stepped out of the elevator into the lobby. As he came into view, I knew this was the man to whom I was directed. More exuded from him than merely a warm, pleasant personality. I could tell this man possessed deep understanding and a great deal of knowledge. In fact, he reminded me of some of the space people I had met. I introduced him to my party, but felt it unwise to mention what the space people had told me, while in the presence of the others, and looked forward to an opportunity to talk with him alone. That proved to be difficult. First, we attended his lecture, which was jammed to capacity. Afterward, I tried to speak with him privately, but that was impossible because of the throngs which surrounded him. Before long, I could see our conversation was generally public, and my pictures were being passed around for all to see. I discovered, however, that George and I were comparing notes telepathically, and I was firmly convinced he was the man I was seeking. Within the week, he came to my home, where he gave lectures to selected groups. We appeared on the Long John radio show, and the Steve Allen TV show, and the story really broke. No longer did I have a private life of my own. Hundreds of people thronged a home in Highbridge, and from there on we had no peace in our household. Our visitors ranged from sincere individuals, to reporters, curiosity seekers, investigators, but I talked with all of them. Suddenly, during one of George's private lectures at my home, I recognized someone who was to bring even more changes into my life. As he spoke, I noticed a slim, attractive, young blonde woman raptly listening to the lecture, and I knew at once who she was. My mind flashed back to a prediction the woman from another world had made. She said I would meet a young woman who closely resembled the girl he had met years before, as a child, in the forest. She said her name would be Marla. I breathed the name. Marla. And the memory blocks began to disappear. She gave no sign of recognizing or noticing me. But I knew this was the girl who would work with me in the future, bringing once again into fulfillment a past affiliation on another planet, and a promise. Then another realization overtook me, and I unwillingly pulled my eyes from her. This girl was not from another planet in this reincarnation. She was of the Earth. Apparently, I was not the only one who sensed something different about the lovely young woman with the faraway look in her eyes. A friend from New York called me aside and asked if I had noticed her. "There is something about her," he said. Then he repeated it, "something about her, but I just don't know what it is." Almost automatically I replied, "Yes. There is something unusual about her, and we will see a lot of her in the future." At the same time I spoke, I knew that the work that I was to do on this planet would soon require a difficult personal decision. It is a pity that many of us who are working here suffer from memory blocks which are unveiled only after we have already become established in a way of life, in my case, married, with children and the attendant obligations. It would take a great amount of understanding for one or both of the partners to redefine their lives along original purposes. It was the visitors who assisted me in breaking through the memory block with which I was born on this planet. All of us have past lives. Some have expressed themselves on this planet in other bodies, other locations, but none of us originated on Earth. Thus, life is an endless variety of continual growth. In the beginning I had found a great many things the space people told me difficult to believe, but the more awareness I received, the more I was able to understand the truth of my own soul and its various expressions. Now I was beginning to see into past lives and derive at many answers to the questions I had so often asked myself. All of us have lived through hundreds of incarnations on various worlds. Some of us have volunteered to come to this planet and be reborn in Earth bodies. We have volunteered to help in the work of helping other people receive the gifts of awareness. One can believe in these gifts on a purely intellectual level, defining their logic through rationalization, but believing is not knowing. To know a thing, one must experience it. Have you ever experienced some illuminating truth which flashed across your mind and gave an answer to a particular problem which had been worrying you? Or, perhaps, suddenly given insight into more profound subjects, And then, suddenly, the next instant, it was gone. Yet the memory of this brief illumination remained with you in your mind, but you can never find words with which to explain it to others. This is what I mean by knowing. It is difficult to put the knowing into words to those who do not know, or to those who only believe or imagine a thing to be true, without having experienced it. This gradual awareness and knowing comes with evolvement of the soul, mind and body, which are ever striving upward toward perfection and oneness with our Infinite Father. Once the memory block is broken, we do not need the constant surveillance or help from our space brothers. We are finally on our own. Only then we do experience a thrill even more satisfying than meeting and talking with these advanced people, the joy we receive as we help others achieve what have achieved. A few things I say will not conform to many of our orthodox religions. The occult sciences, however, do touch upon some of these subjects, yet many of these metaphysical teachings sometimes go off on tangents which rob the reality of everyday life applications from them. It may often be the aura of mystery many exponents of such teachings draw unnecessarily into them which are responsible for their failure to achieve practicality. Science asks for proof, but how can we prove something which is beyond our sciences? Scientific proof is based on what we perceive with our five senses, not what we know with the use of even more valuable senses. But, somehow, out of these advanced ideas must come a science, a system of some kind, else our uncharted paths will become even wilder. Such a science, a cosmic science, which will involve investigations into the realm of other senses and dimensions, has already had its humble beginnings, but its patriarchs, like those ancient iconoclasts who announced the world was round and was not the center of the universe, have been persecuted. Man's research has penetrated millions of light years into the universe, and into the almost inestimable depths of the atom, but now he must do research into an even more mysterious and difficult subject, man himself. In talking of past lives, I should clarify the term, karma, as it has been explained to me. If you wish it, there is such a thing as karma, which one might term a compensative hereditary expression in this physical three-dimensional world of now. You can live above karmic conditions when the gift of awareness is yours. But woe to those who are slaves of karma, and cannot leap its prison walls. To those who say they are resigned to live under this system of karmic retribution, let me say this: it is a false and artificial condition, one which takes on reality only because you agree that it should be so. Jesus said, "Know the truth and the truth shall make you free." Those who die on this planet without knowing the truth or having the gifts of awareness, are prisoners of this planet and do not leave it. They are reborn in new bodies and continue in the school of life, bound to the wheel of karma. Those, however, who die knowing the truth are not afraid to die. They know there is no death in truth, and that they may be reborn on another planet, in the worlds of the space friends. For example, a veritable heaven compared to Earth. Heaven is not an isolated place, instead there are degrees of heavens. Some souls who choose to be reborn here from another planet do so for a purpose, either to accomplish a mission or to be with some loved one. But whether they progress upward or downward, there is continual evolvement. At the lecture I caught myself wondering if it was the soul of myself or Marla which had voluntarily cast itself once more into the hell of Earth. Perhaps it had been that of both of us. 22. Natural couples. Marla had so greatly resembled the girl on the rock I felt certain she must be the person to whom the alien woman had referred. I remembered our parting in June, 1946, when I asked her if we should ever meet again. She had answered in the negative, but added a statement which greatly puzzled me. "No, Howard, but one will come who is my sister. She will work with you and be with you for the duration of this lifespan. She is my incarnated on this planet some years ago in your state of New Jersey. She is not too far from you at this moment. One day you will meet her." "How shall I know her?" "Don't worry, you will recognize her the moment your eyes fall upon her. Once in her presence you will know that she is the one of whom I speak. And you will discover she looks very much like me. At that time I had not envisioned any particular person, though I believe I pictured an earth woman of mature years who might assist in my work and nothing more. A younger woman would conflict with my marital state. 10 years later, while listening to George Van Tassel speak, I had seen Marla for the first time, and as the girl on the rock had stated, I recognized her instantly. I looked at a silent, serious young woman with a sad face. My first recognition came not from physical appearance, but a feeling of oneness with the soul of the girl. And as I looked at her face carefully, my heart almost jumped out of my body. Marla bore a striking resemblance to the girl in the rock. She was shorter, and her hair, tied in a tight severe bun at the nape of her neck, was not quite as like the blonde as that of the alien woman. Her eyes were blue-green with flecks of gold, and the space friends had been golden. Yet my breath almost stopped when I noticed the similarity. I inquired about the young lady, learning she had recently become widowed. Asking Van to come with me in order to give me courage to meet her, we walked over to her after the lecture, and I renewed an association with someone who had been very close to me in the past. I remember her blushing when Van told her that she bore a scar on her upper leg, one of the ways in which certain people are marked and are known to their owners one of themselves. Marla smiled and said, "But I have never seen a flying saucer, or had a contact with a space person." To which Van replied somewhat enigmatically, "You don't have to." Since I had first looked at her, my memory veil had been lifting. I knew I had known her before and had loved her and that we were meant to be one. While this was a happy revelation, it was also tragic, for I was already married. I was in a state of confusion, divided between fond anticipation and sorrowful foreboding of what would occur in my family life. But after the first meeting, Marla and I were irresistibly drawn to each other, and though both of us tried to fight off the predicted outcome, we were caught up in the overwhelming remembrance of a long-ago promise to each other. I do not remember all my life on Federation worlds, but I recall being part of a family with parents, brothers and sisters. I was a spiritual teacher who instructed the young. I had at my disposal a spacecraft which I used for traveling to different planets for the purpose of both teaching and gaining knowledge. I taught many subjects, including the positive use of telepathic projection, and the study of God's universal laws. Although my original intent was to touch only briefly on the subject of natural couples in order to save the embarrassment and pain of discussing the tragedy in my marital life, I have decided it best to explain the reasons for an unfortunate situation. My first knowledge that something was happening both to myself and to my first marriage came shortly after I returned from the army, when Rose was heard to remark, "Howard is not the same man that I married." At that time I was not aware of my emergence as my true self, and subsequent misunderstandings pain me deeply. When I had been quite young I had married the lovely, dark-haired girl whom I had met while working at Picatinny Arsenal. Our backgrounds were entirely different, which at that time made little difference to us, usually the case when very young couples first meet and share the novelty and spell of romance. Parents, older and often wiser, know that in time, when the flush of romance dims, couples are faced with the down-to-earth and everyday prospect of living with each other. And at that time the basic characters and temperaments, due to background, training and other factors, finally emerge. When we are young we cannot see these differences which stem from variation in mental and spiritual development. Our interest is usually based mainly on physical attraction and common interests of the moment. This is a story which is lived so frequently I need not go into it at great length. On other planets, of which I have some knowledge, couples come together by natural selection, that is they know their proper mates. The considerations by which they choose mates involve mainly the state of evolvement of each individual. They choose their mates by a spiritual awareness of what constitutes perfect and complete union. They know a complete union must include all levels of development, spiritual, mental, emotional and physical. in spirit like attracts like. As to the mental level, if the training has not been similar, then the capacities for mental development should be similar. In the emotional and physical levels we first encounter the law of polarity, whereby opposites attract each other. That is why, as on earth, an extremely virile man is attracted to a very feminine woman. We find this situation also operating in reverse. How many times have we observed a strong-willed, dominant, almost masculine woman married to a quiet, retiring little man, whom she leads around by the nose? We laugh at the situation, but we should admire. The gentle, often effeminate-looking man is strongly attracted to the woman who is physically and emotionally just his opposite, and the couple is happy. When two individuals are of like polarity, they repel each other, as do the same poles of two magnets. If both members of a marriage union are of a strong, positive nature, there is friction and antagonism. If both are of a negative, receptive nature, always waiting for someone else to take the lead, then neither does anything, and the union lacks creativeness and progress. The entire concept of proper mating is to bring out the best possible expression in both individuals. Together they should blend spiritually and mentally, but emotionally and physically complement each other and make a perfect unit of expression. Union and mating is not only a biological and social mechanism for the procreation and rearing of children, but also for the soul's development in fullest expression. If a marriage does not fulfill natural mating requirements, the two persons are antagonistic, resentful, lack in creative interest in life, and contributing little to their own union, themselves, or their fellow man. They are better off separated than continuing an armed truce on the battlefield of an incompatible union. This simple law, that in spirit like attracts like, and in the flesh opposites attract each other, is the basis for happy mating. The space people know this law, apply it and teach it to their children, so that early in life their offspring know and recognize suitable mates well in advance of the formal selection. Since evolvement is an individual process, differences in growth can occur, even on the other planets. When this does happen and there is a genuine difference in the spiritual growth and physical attunement, these people part with understanding and find more suitable mates. Natural couples who find each other choose each other over and above everyone else. They stay together, not by law or by force, but by their own choice, and are far happier than those couples who stay together because of law, social conditions or convenience. Thus natural selection is morally honest and spiritually valid. On this planet we rarely make natural selection of mates. But fortunate indeed are the souls who chance upon it. On Earth we have a word for it far more expressive, I believe, than do the space people. Here we call it true love. Children born of couples who do part on the other planets are loved and cared for the by all. Children mature at a much faster rate. For example, on the planets of the space friends, a child 2 years old generally possesses physical and mental development enjoyed by an Earth child of 7. Couples on the planets of the space friends stay together much longer than Earth couples, if only due to the fact that they live much longer than we do. Their unions last hundreds of years and sometimes continue for several lifetimes. I believe this is as good a commentary upon their ways of selecting mates as one could offer. In my own life, after several years of marriage, and particularly when my contacts became more frequent, differences in mental and spiritual makeup became more evident. Really, it isn't anybody's fault when this happens to a marriage, and nobody should be blamed. There should be no cause for recrimination or bitterness. Instead, an attempt should be made to approach the problem in the light of understanding and to the best interest of all concerned. I realize that in our society this is a delicate and extremely sensitive problem, and to date we have not adequately solved it. Perhaps if we teach our children how to select mates, first by spiritual attunement, second by mental pursuits and like interests, and third, by emotional complements, we need not teach them the fourth, for physical attraction of opposites is always in operation on the material level. Sometimes it does occur that when individuals are of different stages of development, the one who is more advanced will choose to remain with the one who is slowly advancing. Perhaps it is a case of previous commitment or karmic obligation, though often it is needless waste. I would like to think that my wife and I parted as friends and with understanding. As humans touch each other's lives with purposes, sometimes need part with purpose. 23. Cross-country lecture tour. There are probably many reasons why a million listeners have taken Long John Nebel to their hearts. Some listeners will credit it to his fairness in handling controversial subjects and people, others his open-mindedness, still others his personality. The biggest reason for his popularity, however, is no doubt his capacity for bringing out the most interesting facets of the personalities he interviews. I shall always remember my first appearance on the show, when I went to the studio with George Van Tassel. I was rather scared, not having been on radio before, but Long John soon put me at my ease, and Van's staunch support and sincere help gave me the courage I needed. The biggest point of discussion was how I was able to take pictures of the spacecraft without any available light source. Van presented such an explicit description of how it was done that I here present his actual words, taken from a tape recording of the show broadcast October 30, 1956. Van: "Well, John, this is further proof of what I have been trying to bring to the people for a long time. It is the greatest thing in our recorded history, and certainly in a free country it is the property of all the people. What Howard has brought forth here tonight," he referred to the photographs, "I consider, with my knowledge of the Polaroid camera and experience with the craft, authentic. I also consider them authentic for this reason: these were taken at different distances, and the perspective is perfect for the distances. The ship is emitting the same type of light as the one I contacted. The ship is luminous of itself. You don't need flash bulbs to take a picture of a ship at night. Now, you asked Howard if this particular ship spun or seemed to spin, and he said that he noticed a spinning action, or something appeared to be spinning. John, I would like to read from one of the messages he received telepathically to verify this particular thing he could not quite describe. This is in the book I have printed on telepathic information, and dated August 24, 1952. Note: as mentioned earlier, Van Tassel's channelings were from opposing groups feeding Van Tassel disinformation to discredit his message. This was also stated on the Alliance website that can be found online.luis, in the Love and Peace of Eternal Light, greetings to the mortal beings of Shan, Earth. I am Ashtar. Let me first inform you that we are grateful for your continual efforts in maintaining this contact power, for the information of your scientific minds throughout the planet, Shan. Our ventless do not spin. The emanation of spiral radiation from a ship's give the illusion of spinning. The upper or positive polarity of the ventler radiates emanations outwardly from the center due to the collection and concentration of light particles through a vortice funnel in the center unseen. These light emanations radiating outward appear such as grooves unknown of your phonograph records. The lower negative polarity operates in reverse. This light substance emanation is contained within a field of zero circumference, which is void, giving the impression of an egg. Your spectroscopic camera will reveal us only as light in the spectrum plus elements in your atmosphere. Advance this information also to those who still doubt. LJ: "Well, the only way you can find out whether there is any truth to any subject is to get all sides of the story. Now I know that one who talks about these subjects is frowned upon. I, myself, can't buy this story, and I am frank to admit it. I definitely agree with George Van Tassel, that this is not a man who has come out here to fool anybody, much less, he is not interested in fooling George Van Tassel. And I would say the same thing for Arthur R. O. Van. I know several million people have sighted these ships. There is a feeling of ridicule, and the fact that they won't report these to the military has created an unhealthy condition in this country, and I am bringing this out on the side of our government. I think we have the finest form of government in the world. I am talking for the government, not for myself, in that respect. LJ, why should we keep it a secret? What have we got to lose?